your co-host Kenny Buller. I'm a clap the trappers,
cause y'all in the for them actors. Welcome on the Second Floor Podcast. I've been rolling around with all my goons and all
my savages. I just want the dudes. We would have dreamt of something like this, and here it is. Ray Ray with the heaters, got the tracks sounding immaculate.
Looking kinda dapper, but it be chilling. It's no matter about my business, so I spit. What's going on, y'all? It's Cash is back on the Second Floor Podcast. We haven't done one of these in a while, in-person guest interview. We got a special guest in the house. We got Joel Shackleton. What's going on?
Not much, man. Sunday morning?
Sunday morning pod.
Yeah, I got a kid, though, so I've been up for multiple hours.
Oh,
I feel like this is probably... You're getting me at my best, so let's hope.
Oh.
Things are good.
Fantastic. I love that.
Sunday mornings for a dad of a three-year-old, I'm telling you. That's when they're dialed in.
Yeah. That's awesome, man. Well, I appreciate you coming on. Obviously, you know, we've talked about this for a little bit of having you on, and I'm excited to kind of dive in, not only sort of in your career and kind of your journey, but also getting into this episode a lot about finances, a lot about, you know, the economy and some investment tips as well. So I'm excited to dive in.
Hey, me too, man.
Yeah.
I hope I can share some experience.
Yeah. I think from just, you know, obviously us working together for the last little bit, kind of understanding, even you have a podcast called The Reform Millennials Podcast, and you spit game on that pod.
Oh yeah,
you spit a lot of game.
I talk a lot. I'm not sure if it gets through, but I definitely have a lot of opinions. That's one thing that people will get from my podcast, is a lot of opinions.
Yeah, but I like it, because even like we, you know, when even with me or the team that's filming and we're listening to it and editing the podcast, we realize, you know, some of the things that you talk about are very valuable, especially for Millennials.
Yeah.
The podcast is titled.
Yeah, definitely. You know what? The focus of the podcast has always been around this idea of kind of reforming the way that people view the millennial. And I think at the beginning, a good 5 years ago, it was the global assumption that millennials were lazy or entitled or perhaps didn't want to work or even had inappropriate opinions on what it was meant to be a family person or somebody who was an entrepreneur or a whole host of these things. And over the last 5 years, I think through a pretty tumultuous pandemic period, and then I'd say two stock market recessions, one real one, and then one kind of created, and you have a new perception of the millennial. And I think largely, I think it's earned, but also an aging of our generation, which I think is good. And I'm not saying it's because of my podcast, it definitely isn't. But yeah. Kind of, if you go back to the beginning and I listen to some of my previous pods and then to the more recent stuff, I feel like the what I'm trying to accomplish with the podcast is remain the same, but it also, there's been this weird evolution. And I think it's just me educating myself, staying committed to education, and then trying to convey that to an audience, and then showing my growth, and then hopefully theirs comes with it. It's been a nice path. I mean, it's a focus on politics, economics, investing, and people's careers, probably mostly from a male perspective, but that's all I got. So kind of just sharing my experience. I go from the podcast when I'm earlier on in my career to, I'd say I'm quite a bit more cemented now, and I've gone through been invested in a number of different things, whether it be venture to private equity, to real estate, to the stock market. I have a ton of experience there, plus the new family, all that stuff, kind of living the life of the millennial.
Yeah.
Guy in his late 20s, early 30s, and like that's what's happening for me.
Yeah.
And it comes through in my podcast, I hope.
For sure. And I think, you know, just talking about that, is you're honestly one of the, I would say, the avatar for the perfect guest for our podcast, because when we started, the whole idea of the Second Floor is to basically get to the next level, or get to the second floor was the idea. Mm-hmm. And so when we initially started, it was, you know, bringing on entrepreneurs, C-suite executives, leaders in specific industries, and just asking them about their journey and talking about it. And that's kind of what we're doing today, but kind of getting that understanding, because even, you know, as us being in our, you know, I'm now early 30s now, but you know, when I started, it was early mid 20s. I had no clue where my career was going. I had, you know, there were so many uncertainties. And I think the reason I started the pod is to get an understanding from individuals who have excelled in their space, mm-hmm. or who have that experience to kind of give us game, to be like, what are your thoughts on how we should go about our careers or finances or personal life, self-development, all that sort of jazz. So I'm excited to dive in today with you. And before we get into all the, you know, the finance stuff or investment stuff or anything like that, I want to know how you got into this space. Your early beginnings of your career. When did you decide to take the path that you're on right now? And kind of where did it all start?
So, I started working early as a power engineering, worked in the oil and gas sector, materials, manufacturing, that sort of thing. Did that for the first 7-8 years of my career. And then I met this guy who managed people's money for a living. And he managed some of the family money, not mine, but like some people in my family on the other side. And he was in my opinion, probably one of the greatest salespeople I've ever met. And I found a lot of interest in it. I had been on a ton of Reddit forums and investing forums. And while I was at work, that was just kind of like a small hobby for me. Then I met this fella in Fort Saskatchewan, and he kind of took me under his wing in a sense, in terms of teaching me the financial industry from a sales and from a public markets perspective. And teaching you the ropes around the RSPs and TFSAs and how to properly manage your money.
Right.
So I go and I work for this guy on the side while I'm doing my day-to-day job, my 9-to-5. And I'm door knocking, I'm cold calling, I'm cold emailing. I'm kind of learning the front ropes or the front lines and the tip of the spear in terms of how to build a business on the financial management side. And it's a grind for like 3 years. Right. And I'm working for Raymond James on the side, and I finally get to the point where I have enough client business that I've been able to wrangle in where I can quit my 9-to-5 oil and gas job. So at this point, I'm like 26, 25 years old, and I'm going from what I call the golden handcuffs, because I had a great career. I was making very good money, but I didn't find any passion in it. I would say I wasn't even that good at it, because my favorite quote is to not to do things that you love, but to do what you're good at, and then inevitably you will love it. And in this case, I was quite good at talking about investing. I found a lot of, I obviously loved it, but quite frankly, I liked what other people thought of me when I was talking about it. And that made me feel good. So I really ran with that, and it fed me into where I'm at today. So I build my business with Raymond James. I go to a small independent for 5 years, and I build my book up quite quickly. And through that pandemic period, from the time I started my podcast through a good 5 years, I built my book to the point in which one of the big banks were like, yeah, we want you to come over. We'd like for you to bring your business. So I take my business to RBC, Dominion Securities, and now I'm here talking to you.
Yeah.
And it was a lot of trials, tribulations, learnings from an understanding of how markets work, to how people work, to realizing that rich people don't love talking to young people, but if you can prove yourself and show that you know what you're talking about, and that you can be not just good enough to understand what's going on, but to be able to explain to them and make them understand and do new things and be progressive in how they approach their finances, the way that they're investing, whether it be publicly or privately, that ability of mine to do for them has really translated into me being able to kind of take it up into the next level and change the people that I'm around and working with as well. That was the biggest and hardest transition from when I was a young guy bringing in young clients, working with younger people, to transitioning from that point to leveling up in my industry anyways. And that's dealing with people that have real problems. They have holding companies, operating companies, they have professional corporations, they have all these different levels of complexity in their financial lives, and then being able to understand that, how to properly invest out of those things, and then leverage all of that to greater wealth in the future. And like me being able to, one, experience and do it myself, but then two, set them up so that they're doing it right.
Right.
And tell that story was its own 8-year experience of failures, successes, roller coaster of understanding. I mean, going through a crazy pandemic period of things working, not working, then working again, and then understanding interest rates, understanding all of this different complexity and putting it all together. And I don't have it 100% figured out, but I have, I think, been able to craft and tell a story of experience combined with progressive youth and a willingness to try new things. And I think that that is kind of what I've crafted in my industry and built my brand out as, which is, I think, quite a bit different than the typical wealth management advisor in the city, you know?
Right.
If you were to go and talk to one, it wouldn't, generally speaking, they might look like me, but they definitely don't, I don't think they talk or have the same experience as me.
Right. No, that's, it's very interesting because like, just so I'm clear, like your role is to, is as a wealth manager, is it? Is
yeah,
it, is that what it's called? Wealth manager. Yeah. So you manage people's money, essentially.
I'm a portfolio manager. Yeah.
Right. So I'm so curious about this is that as a relatively young individual to be able to handle, I'm assuming that your clientele is a little bit older than you.
Generally speaking. Yeah. The average client is definitely older than me, but I also have clients that are younger than me.
Okay.
Yeah.
So these individuals who are, let's just take the older clients of yours who may have a little bit more life experience and have a lot more experience in their space. They've made a ton of money, et cetera, et cetera. How does an individual like that, how do you convince an individual like that to work with a guy like you who's a little younger, who might not have the life experience or might not know about certain things or whatever? Like you said, you don't, might not have 100% of like, you might not know everything, but you have a decent amount of experience. So I'm sitting across the room from Joel and you want to essentially have this individual in your portfolio. How do you convince an individual like that?
Well, and this is where, I don't know if this is even where we want to go with this conversation, but for young people trying to work with, call it, you know how there's like this cart before the horse, the chicken before the egg situation with young people where they're like, every job I try to apply for requires me to have 5 years experience. How do I get 5 years experience if I'm required to have 5 years experience? I have all the other prerequisites, right?
Yeah.
And in my case, there's this, the faking before you make it sort of thing.
Right.
The starting of the podcast was a huge thing for me because it allowed for people to listen to me, whether they be older or younger, and be able to see that I know what I'm talking about.
Mm.
And then as a result of that, they will then come to me in many ways, in many respects. So whether it be their kid who's listening to my podcast and being like, Dad, I know your guy sucks. Listen to this guy. I'm telling you, it'll be worth your time. That was one barrier breakdown approach for me.
Right.
But truthfully, it's also finding the right partnerships as well. So for instance, I have in my office, I have a partner who is older. And if I'm needed, or if it's needed that I need to bring in a gray hair, I will. I'm not big enough to say like, no, I don't need any of that. No, I do. And he has a ton of experience in developing businesses and family companies and those sorts of things. And that's sometimes required. But if I'm talking to somebody I'm trying to give advice to in this space, or let's say hypothetically, I am in a spot where I'm talking to this 55-year-old, sold his business, he's got $20 million that he needs to have properly invested, and he's looking at me. The one beauty of successful entrepreneurs who have sold their business is that when they see a younger person, they're hopeful that they might see themselves in that person.
Mm.
And I think that the successful entrepreneur is more than willing to trust and work with a younger individual because they were that person at one point. But if you don't tell that to them and show them that, it's going to be very challenging for them to trust you. Right. So that doesn't always work, and not, and maybe perhaps I'm not for everybody, but in many cases, and in from my perspective, it very much has been my experience that if I can do that for them, they view it as a very positive thing. They also see the, at least in investing, younger youthfulness, progressiveness, those things tend to be or result in really great returns. And if you can tell that to somebody, that would be, that tends to land. It can land. And right. then they're very interested in it.
Right.
But it's all a whole combination of things. Like, I work with the largest institution in the country. You have the right backing so that you can then push forward with a good package that is interesting to these people. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't work for everyone. Sometimes they always want that 60-year-old gray hair, and that's fine.
Right.
But if you can combine the two,
yep.
if you're building your services package, if you're someone listening to this being like, man, how do I get into selling these people? Well, in my opinion, you understand who you are and what you bring to the table. And when it comes to young people, it's usually youth, energy, new ideas.
Yeah.
I mean, quite frankly, if you were to ask a 55-year-old what's interesting in the market right now, or what's interesting in popular culture, it's going to be very challenging for them to give the same answer as a 22-year-old, right? And even me being 34 and having a 3-year-old, it's hard for me to understand what the 20-year-old person who's consuming 3 hours of TikTok a day is truly interested in.
Right.
But to be able to look into that and try to craft a story as to where the market is going and understand that that is incredibly important, and then position people so that they're eternal. I mean, that is my biggest strength, and that's how I do it. So if I'm sitting here with the business owner that just sold his oil and gas company, or he sold his services business or e-commerce company, and he's like, why would I use a 34-year-old wealth manager? Well, you're going to use me because I know what's coming next, or at least I'm dedicated to knowing what's coming next. And I have a good understanding. I've read enough about the past to understand that there's a lot of utility in what has worked in the past. And then combining the two, putting it to work in your holding company assets, your personal assets, and then also telling that story down the line, making it so that your children that are going to inherit everything understand and adhere to what you want, and then also working with you to ensure that your lifelong wealth that you've built over the last 30 years is going to last another 100. So that's what I'm trying to do for people. That's what I'm trying to do for business owners, and I try to convey that to them.
Yeah.
It takes a long time.
Mm-hmm.
They don't usually sit down and interview me for an hour and a half and be like, okay, I know what you're saying. They're never going to ask questions like this.
Yeah.
Right?
For sure.
You have to be able to sell that. And that's part of the art, I think.
Yeah. I think sales or selling is a crucial skill, and especially in this day and age, for anything.
I wish more people viewed it that way. I don't care if you're a doctor.
Mm-hmm.
You still have to sell your service. I know it's effectively, I'm a doctor, there's endless patients, but if you want a good role inside the hospital, you're selling. If you want to have the best service hours, if you want to perhaps have work at the right hospital, if you want to land your internship, but like your residency in the city that you want, you're selling. You're always selling.
Always. Totally agree with that. And that's very interesting, Joel, especially understanding kind of your sort of background and how you kind of got into it. What would be the biggest challenge that you, maybe one or two of the biggest challenges that you faced as you started building your book up, through your, you know, early to mid 20s, you know, starting your business, going into that, and then coming here like today, obviously with RBC. But I want to know, like, within that, is there one moment or is there one or two particular challenges or stories that you can share with our audience of like a specific challenge that you faced that it was such a big challenge or obstacle for you?
It's imposter syndrome.
Okay.
Definitely. You always think that you're fake, and you don't realize, you don't know what you don't know. And you also don't know what your competition does on a day-to-day basis. So you always think that the older, more successful, larger book is better than you, and that you feel as though while you might be small, 20, 30, 40 million bucks, and then this person's is running 6, 7, 800 million or 2 billion. And you're like, that guy must be so good. That, she must be so much better than me. And to an extent, they have more experience, but you also have your own unique qualities as well. And the grind is that, at least in my industry, you eat what you kill. So it can be a little tight sometimes. And not only that, you're paid based on your performance along with sales performance and how the market's doing. And that can be a roller coaster.
Right.
You can go through some really tough times. But at the end of the day, if you have a belief in yourself, but even a proper commitment to consistency, and that can mean anything, whether it be like exercise or whatever, but daily routine, right, whatever you want to watch on YouTube.
Morning routines.
Yeah. if you just jump into a cold bath for 45 seconds every morning.
Yeah.
Honestly, it's none of that. It's more so along the lines of a commitment to your process and in your career. And for me, that was a commitment to writing and to producing content. Even if it was the smallest thing, whether it be a newsletter or posting on Facebook or posting on Instagram or whatever it might be, I'm throughout my late 20s, which is where I built my book up in my early 30s. It was a belief in the idea of 1,000 true fans.
Mm.
And for me, that was this is not my theory. This is an old,
not Tim Ferriss, somebody else.
No, but he popularized it. And like he had the guy who wrote the white paper on his podcast way back. And that's actually where I kind of initially listened to it. And it's, I can't remember if it was Eugene Wee who wrote a iteration of it. But the ideology of it is basically if you can build 1,000 fans, whether it be a Facebook group or an Instagram following or a YouTube subscriber list, and 1,000 doesn't seem like that much, especially nowadays, right? Like you have people that have every Tom and Sarah has 1,000 followers on Instagram or something like that, right? Yeah. But I mean, generally speaking, they're friends, family, right?
Yeah.
But if you can find 1,000 people that are dedicated to you and listening to you, you won't want for anything. Whether you're selling shaker cups or you're selling financial services or perhaps you're selling books or classes. If you have 1,000 people dedicated to you and believe in what you're saying, you can then have a very successful business. And my approach was always, you know what, if I do what's right and do the best to the best of my abilities, and then further to that, have a consistent approach to it, there'll be enough people that believe in me, that think that the way that I convey myself, that I handle, I deal with my family, deal with my business and invest, they'll be committed to me. They'll want to use me and I'll be able to build a strong business around it. And that's been true. And it doesn't matter what it is. Financial services tends to have a good margin and a good business behind it. And it allows for me to take this long-term approach. But young people do not want to take the long-term approach anymore.
Yeah.
And if you do, though, if you're willing to be like, I'm going to put in the work for 10 years and you stay committed to it every single day in terms of being like, okay, I'm going to write, I'm going to produce content. I don't care if you get 4 likes.
Yeah.
It doesn't actually matter, because what you will notice is that compounded change in how people perceive you on a interpersonal basis will start to pay dividends. And I see it a lot now where someone has listened to me from the time they're 24 to 30, and now they know somebody, or they themselves have now won an award, or they're now making lots of money, or their parents have an exit and now they need help managing money, or they inherited money from their grandparents and they've been listening to this podcast, or maybe they even have a friend whose parents have passed away and left their buddy a ton of money, and they've been listening to me for a year or 2 years. And they're like, man, you should be talking to this person. You shouldn't be going to this guy at the bank. You should be going and talking to him because he understands us or has lived a similar life to us. That is where this compounding, this 1,000 true fans has been, that focus has been the core to, I think, any success if I've had any.
Right. That's amazing. I mean, I think that's an incredible advice. And I think that's probably the hardest thing today, because it's funny because I know people that are outside of my circle that have hundreds of thousands of followers. And you look at their social media or their website, their presence, and you're like, man, like they must be, you know, you start comparing yourself or you start comparing that, like you and them, and you're like, man, that following today doesn't have that much of an impact. And what I mean by that is that you could have a million followers on TikTok and people don't know who you are still. Like, mm-hmm. you know what I mean? Like that's the crazy thing about that. But at the same time, there's been this sort of divide because of the short-term content that's being posted. I feel like short-term content is almost like bait, right? And depending on what, again, this is depending on what sort of content you're creating, but it's easy to bait people in and look at a very like super nice cinematic video and be like, oh man, this is awesome. Follow, right? I want to follow this channel. But in order to like really build 1,000 true fans, it really takes a little bit more meat and depth to your content.
So and consistency. For
and sure. consistency, mm-hmm. right? So it's one of those things that although you might have 100,000 people following you, they might not be like fans of you. They might be fans of the content. Mm-hmm. And that's something that I've noticed is like the people that I follow, or at least I know the people that my friends follow and I follow individuals that... I follow individuals that might have entertaining content. I might follow a meme page. I might follow a cinematic film page because I'm a filmmaker/producer. I might follow those things, but the individual that's creating that content, in order for me to be a fan of that individual, I need more meat on the bone. Mm-hmm. And so their long-term like their longer form content, when they talk about their experiences, when they talk about their journey, when they talk about what they're building or where they're headed, when I can connect to that, then I'm hooked. Mm-hmm. Because then I'm like, I want to know everything about this individual. I want to know their struggles. I'm connected to their story and their journey. Now they might have this superficial, short, like entertaining pieces of 30-second TikTok Definitely. Bites. But I'm not a fan of that individual. I'm just I could be just a fan of that content. Mm-hmm. And that's where I see the 1,000 true fans coming into play is the individuals who have really successfully built a business, whether it's around their personal brand or their business, it's because their audience is able to connect with their long-term content. The content that actually I can understand, okay, I get like you said, someone's been following you from 24 to 28, 4 years, and they understand you, Joel, or they understand like the what your message is and what you're talking about. Maybe, and a lot of it you mix in your personal experience, and not only just you're not just spitting game on finances or whatever. It's just it's also you. It's your personality. You're being authentic to you, and that person is now connected to mm-hmm. you. So whether you sell merch, or whether you sell financial services, or whether you sell water bottles, whatever the case may be, I'm a fan of you. So whatever you're selling, because I'm connected to your story. And that's something that I see time and time and again with successful creators, personal individuals that have personal brands, entrepreneurs who make content, C-suite executives, people that are making content and showcasing their story. And that, once they get those 1,000 true fans, it honestly doesn't matter what they sell. I'm connected to your story, so I'll buy. I'm fully ingrained in your journey and your story, so it doesn't matter what you sell.
I think that like your view of that is it's like this depth of story where you can have someone who has 20 million TikTok followers, subscribers, whatever, and it's super wide, but they have little depth. But what I'm noticing anyways is that if you're getting the proper advice, they're asking you to create additional content depth. So podcasting, long form podcasting, people writing newsletters, finding new ways to monetize or effectively introduce themselves at different layers to their fans. You see Mr. Beast doing this all the time now, where he has the largest following in the world, but it's not, it wasn't necessarily the deepest. And now he's going and he's podcasting, he's creating additional depth to his group. And I think it's table stakes for our generation specifically to engage with the next one. Because if I'm here being, and I'm going to be a financial advisor, portfolio manager, wealth guy for the next 35 years, which is my intention, I need to also have the ability to tell my story down and up. And if I'm trying to be honest about what I'm doing, I need to be able to, well, one, I got to continue to do it, but I also have to continue to build on myself. And I have never been able to go upwards, which is to like get to those million followers and that sort of thing. And I think it's probably because it's inauthentic to me. It's also really hard to do.
Yeah.
You have to have a certain look, a certain approach that doesn't perhaps work for me. And that's fine with me. And I hope that if you're listening to this and you're a young person, you don't think that you need to start at the, I need 100,000 followers to make this profitable, because you really don't. You really, really, really do not need that. You do not need to be Mr. Beast big. You don't need to be even 500,000 subs on YouTube big,
right,
which is a profitable thing. You need, again, 1,000 true fans, which is what I always attached myself to. Maybe that's because it seemed approachable. I'm like, okay, 1,000, that's not bad. Right. I could get to that.
Yeah.
But that's what I actually want people to focus on. It's like, you don't need 100,000 or 200,000 or 300,000 or a million. You truly need that 1,000. And what you got to then focus on is the business model behind it. And if you can figure out a business model that is profitable with 100 clients or 150 clients, and the margins all work all the way up and down, that to me is the approach that young people aren't thinking about enough. Everyone wants to be an influencer and a content creator.
Yeah.
But nobody wants to do the hard business model work behind it.
Yeah.
They're just like, I'll just get the eyeballs and then everything will fall in behind it. And like, yeah, maybe that's true. Mm-hmm. But actually Mr. Beast tweeted this like last week. He was literally like, for every person who makes it big like me, there's hundreds of thousands of people that didn't. And the reason why they didn't make it, it's mostly because one, their approach was a little bit wrong. But two, it's not about being a content creator that, yeah, sure, you can make money doing that. But like, what's behind it? What business is behind it? It can be anything. It could be a paper company. Mm-hmm. It could be anything. It doesn't matter. But if you can build that depth of content stack, mm-hmm. and like to tell your story, what you're doing,
yeah.
on top of your business, your service, production, manufacturing, whatever you're doing, that to me, I wish was better conveyed to young people. Because now it just feels as though they just want to be famous.
Yep. Yeah. Another thing too, just to add to this, Joel, is the idea of how entrepreneurship has been glamorized over the last 5-10 years. And I want to get into this with you just because I want to know your perspective and your opinion on this, where everyone thinks that you got to be your own boss in this day and age, right? Right? Either it's in your own boss or you're an influencer, right? Yeah. One of those two, right?
It's kind of the same thing.
Yeah. It's kind of the same thing. And you see these business owners, Gary Vee, Grant Cardone's, the Alex Hormozy's, all these guys who are at the top, at upper echelon of successful entrepreneur. And they, they're flying around their private jets and you see all this content and then you feel like, damn, like I guess in order for me to get to a point of success, I need to be my own boss. Personally, for me, I've noticed this, again, the chasing of that sort of golden egg, if you will, but it's so much more harder than that in order to really make something that is a success. So I'm curious to know from your front, what do you think, do you need to be your own boss to be successful? And if not, what are other paths or what are other routes that guys in our age or younger should be thinking about when it comes to this sort of topic?
In order to fly private in your 30s, or have a private jet in your 30s, you probably got to be your own boss. That's almost a certainty. But that's not happiness or success necessarily. I don't have that. Like,
right.
Will I? I don't know. Hopefully, maybe. Great. Yeah. But it's not how I identify as my success, obviously.
Yeah.
This is going to be super corny, but I should be identifying my success by my, I have son, I have one on the way, my wife, my relationship with my wife. I got a beautiful family, those sorts of things. That's like the identification, in my opinion, of success and the strength of those relationships. Now, of course, if we were going to go back to a young person that doesn't even have that, and they're looking to build up their self professionally and then their career, I think that it's important to one, identify what, like, be true to yourself. Be like, can I be a boss? Like, am I going to be the entrepreneur, or is there perhaps a come to Jesus moment and be like, okay, maybe I can make it as a role within a business, whether that be a startup or a more established business. But as a young person, you're much better off going and finding a mentor or finding someone that you admire, or that in an industry or sector that you find to be industry or interesting, and then approach it from there. A 20-year-old entrepreneur, unless you got some sort of really interesting wedge that can get into an industry, solve a problem, and then you're going to dedicate your next 10 years of your life to that. And I hope you understand that that is very rare, and it's unlikely that your idea is going to work. Mm-hmm. You're much better off going the route that your parents probably would have told you to take.
Mm. That's a tough pill to swallow.
Very tough. And most people are like, don't go to university, start a business. Like, all of that. Yeah. If I have to listen to that anymore, I'm going to be upset, because I feel as though the next 20 years of the most recent generation going through their 20s and 30s is going to recognize that it might not have been such a bad idea to go into dentistry, go into med school, or becoming an engineer. Because go and get an understanding and build your own depth.
Yes.
Read, learn. You don't know anything yet. Mm-hmm. I still don't know everything yet. I need to have that gray hair in my life. I need to be able to understand that I don't know everything. I have my core capacity and capabilities that I'm good at. Mm-hmm. My willingness to learn is, like, in my industry, second to none, I think.
Right.
But with that said, you need to recognize that you don't know everything, and that there's a ton of value in learning how to work and how to work for somebody and to take direction, to understand that there's a lot of, like, operational learnings that you need to gather, how to properly build supply chain. Like, everyone thinks they can just go and drop ship because they watched a YouTube video for 15 minutes.
Yeah, yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And now, if there was a dollar, if I had a dollar for everybody I know who tried to be a dropship king,
yeah.
I mean.
Oh, for sure.
Right? So I think that there's a ton of opportunity in making a lot of money in being a good employee.
Yeah.
Not everybody has to be the king, because mm-hmm. if that was the case, there's going to be a lot of people failing. So whether it's commercial real estate, you can make multi-millions of dollars being just a good salesperson in that space. You don't have to be your own boss. Whether it be development, like real estate development, or, I mean, shoot, the amount of people you and I have probably run into that have made their money in that space is quite significant. And they're not their own boss. They're just really good at it, and they help a guy who owns.
Yeah.
I think any industry, you'll be able to find that. Mm-hmm. Now, obviously, you go work for the city, it's unlikely that that'll be the case.
Yeah.
And maybe that is what you want to do. And maybe that is, you just want to help people.
Yeah.
But what I see on social media and Twitter and in my day-to-day, the young person who is entrepreneurial, trying to make it, trying to find their own way, there is nothing wrong with going and working under somebody for 10 years into your 30s and then identifying, okay, I'm good at this part. This is what I'm going to take from him. And I'm going to either, one, hey, maybe he recognizes that you're really good. And then he's going to be like, you should go out on your own. I'm going to fund you. Here's some money. Go and make it happen. You've now built up a network, which we haven't talked about enough. Like, that is the most important thing. Mm-hmm. Two, an understanding of the actual industry that you're in, because you've spent 8, 9, 10 years in it. Now you see how it works. Mm-hmm. You've failed and you've succeeded. And you can combine that with the limited amount of capital you probably combined together to go and make a shot a real true shot at it.
Yeah.
And it's unlikely that someone under 25 can. Like, sorry, you don't know anybody. You have no money. And you certainly don't have any life experience. So not that there's anything wrong with that, but like, at least have some, be capable of being, of understanding what you don't know.
Right.
Like the, I don't remember what that curve is called. It's like that curve of expertise. It doesn't really matter, but at the top, early on in your life and in your understanding and readings of new topics, you think you've read one article and now you think you're an expert and you know everything. And then the more you read on that subject and you learn, you realize what you don't know. And you're like, oh my goodness, I don't know anything. Mm. The problem is a lot of young people make big decisions too early when they think they know everything. And they then recognize through a ton of failure when they start that they didn't know nothing. Mm-hmm. And they just either burned a bunch of investment bridges, all their money, didn't go to school, all this other stuff, and they're down in this valley of despair. And if they don't have the willingness and the fortitude to like make their way back up, they're in deep trouble. So I think if I was a young person again, I mean, would I change anything? No, I'm a happy guy, but like I made a lot of mistakes too. But the one big thing I did is I went and worked, made some money, met some people, built up my network, and then I jumped off of the proverbial cliff, right, into entrepreneurship.
Right.
After I had worked for 8 years and like, yeah, and built a good nest egg. Not only that, I found my wife.
Yeah.
Like all of these things, these like core tenets to success.
Right.
And I think that was luck. I didn't know I was doing this, by the way. It was, right, just more along the lines of I got lucky doing it, meeting the right person to spend, right, my life with, to then also, she was there to support me and help me out. And then two, the at least, and just enough information to realize what I needed to know to, mm-hmm, to kind of push forward.
Yeah, man. I love that. Everything that you said, I totally agree. And I think there's one statement that I want to ask you, Joel, too, because I hear this. I heard this recently. I don't know if it was I don't know if it was on Instagram or wherever it was, but basically it said that you need $88,000 in Edmonton. You need $88,000 in order to afford a mortgage. So I want to get into this rabbit hole. So yeah, $88,000 for the average individual is quite a bit, especially if you're not, you know, making that kind of money. You know, young people can take a look at this, or guys our age or younger than mid-20s, early-20s, they can look at this, and that $88,000 average seems pretty daunting, especially if you haven't owned a home. You're just, again, coming out of university or working a job that doesn't pay that much, building your career, et cetera, you want to own your first home. But $88,000, there's no way you're getting near that right now. Curious to know what your thought is on
that number. You know, it's funny you say that, and then it makes me think of like what that was for me when I was that age.
Yeah.
So I have a distinct memory of being 17 or 18 years old in high school, like grade 12. And I was sitting at I don't know if anyone has ever been to Costco, but I was sitting in the employee lounge in Costco eating, okay, a pizza.
You worked at?
Yeah, I worked at Costco.
Oh, okay. Cool.
In high school.
Yeah.
And during the winter months, and I would do landscaping in the summer. And in this moment, I'm sitting at one of the tables eating lunch on my break, and I'm having a pizza, the Costco pizza, and I have like a mortgage calculator in front of me, and I'm figuring out how much I need to buy the house that I want, the first house that I want. I'm like, oh, I need 42 grand down to buy this place.
Yeah.
Like that is insanely far away.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I'm checking my investment account at this time, and I got Nike and I got, anyways.
Yeah.
I'm like, okay, I feel like I can get there by here.
Yeah. Yeah.
And this is what I'm thinking. Right. And I'm super lucky in that I started early, got a really good job early, worked in the oil and gas industry or industrial industry. And it allowed for me to compound things a little bit quicker. But the $88,000 is also not quite even true. It's more, you also have to have a job.
Yeah.
That's good.
Yeah.
To qualify. Because the qualify is like seven. You have to be qualifying at like a little over seven now, I think, on a.
Yes.
So, one, good luck.
Yeah.
But it's probably accurate.
Yeah.
But I hope if people get anything from our conversation is that the focus on buying a house is too high. It is.
Because that's the
that's what everyone wants.
That's like the Canadian American dream, yeah, like the pinnacle dream. Of like you've made it. You can own a home, right?
It is like capitalism has taught us that.
Yeah,
and I love that. Capitalism is my jam. I feel like it is the core belief of North America.
Yeah,
people will draw back to religion as being no, it's Christianity or Catholicism or Muslim. But no, it's not. It's capitalism. And the reason why I'm not scared of immigration is because our core religion in this country is not some god. It is a god, but it's the god of capitalism. Mm-hmm. And that's why when you see when people talk about we're losing the plot to our moral core, or that our religion's changing, or this group is going to dominate, or this one's going to. I'm like, no, they're not. Because the allure of capitalism wins. It always does. And capital tends to be a larger influence on where things go than perhaps God is, right?
Yeah.
So as a reverse back to that, it's like if you can then, as a younger person, not commit yourself to the home so much as desirable as that is, have a more core belief in, or I should say, a core goal. And yeah, sure, that should be an offshoot benefit of what you do.
Right.
If you can build up your network, that itself is what's important. Get yourself into rooms with people that could, with their monthly earnings, buy you a house. If you can find yourself in a room with in an industry of influential people, and that group takes you in and gives you a place, then start to think about the $88,000. Now that is obviously very privileged of me to say,
right?
And I don't even know where those places are for everybody. I'm just saying, find it.
Yeah.
Because that to me will then, if your goal is to make $88,000, then that's probably what you'll make. But that's not enough. That'll never be enough, because the human condition is to always want more.
Yeah.
So you've obtained that. You've got your 88 grand. Now you pump it into your house. Now you got $5,000 a month in obligations, because you got a house, you got insurance, you got all these things, right?
Yeah.
But you haven't actually accomplished what's really the core need, which is your career. It's right. Your true passions in life.
Because
owning a house is not your true passion.
Yeah.
As much as it is incredibly important.
Totally.
And it is like the core of building your family.
Yeah.
That's not it, man.
Yeah.
It's get that network, get that partner in life also. Find that first.
Yeah.
I keep telling my brother this. I'm like, dude, just find a partner.
Yeah.
Then get your house.
Right.
Stop worrying about the house.
Right.
He always thinks the house then gets the partner.
Right.
No, man, sharing the struggle with her.
Yeah.
And I'm, or him, or whatever, right?
Yeah.
Like, that's not the point.
Yeah.
So, that was me. I mean, yeah, it's a huge issue.
Yeah, yeah.
Housing affordability is a massive problem.
Yeah.
Like, if you, I was reading an article recently where it discussed the required home starts, so builds per year, based on the current immigration into each individual province. And we're making, or in Alberta, I think we're building 19 houses per 100 houses needed. It is just going to get worse. It's not getting any better.
Yeah.
And our immigration is not slowing down.
Yeah.
And because one, we need it. And two, the current policy is not going to go the other direction. So I'm of the opinion that the young people are going to be in for a even harder time buying a house moving forward.
Yeah.
So if you're sitting on the fence between, I can afford it, but I feel like the housing prices are going to go down. No, they're not.
Yeah.
Like everyone wants this crash. I keep reading all this clickbait on Twitter and on the Globe and Mail and BNN about the housing prices in Toronto and Vancouver being down a bit.
Yeah.
But like, no.
No.
Not only that, mortgage rates aren't going back to 2.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Those days are
long gone. They're long gone. And we have this refinancing cliff coming, and it is scary for a lot of people, I think. I currently have a 6% mortgage, and it's a real kick in the rear end.
It is, yeah.
So I think that if the question's about affordability, it's not getting any better. Yeah. But again, in order to deal with that, don't whine about it.
Yeah.
Don't post about it on Twitter or on Instagram and complain, as much as I like doing that myself even.
Yeah.
Solve for it.
Mm-hmm. I love that, man. I wanna kind of pivot the conversation just a little bit, getting into a little bit of sort of the financial sort of stuff. You obviously work, you obviously have a book of clientele that have done probably pretty well for themselves. In your experience or from your clientele that you've seen, whether it's sort of a behavior pattern, skill, industry, what are some tips that you can give to our audience about what these quote unquote successful individuals, whether is it something that they do, something they invest in, a skill that they acquire, like lifestyles, morning routines, I know there's a lot on TikTok and stuff of people waking up at 4:30 in the morning and, going to the gym and go cold bath, all that. Out of everything that you've seen with the high net worth individuals that you've either come across or know, what are some things that are some key takeaways that you've seen and what people should look into? Could be anything, like I said, skill, industry, characteristic. What is that to you? What are some patterns that you see in successful individuals?
So my book consists of a lot of, I work with a lot of professional corporations, which are physicians, specialist physicians, that sort of thing. While a lot of people be like, oh yeah, well that's obvious. They have a core sharing attribute with the group of business owners that perhaps went about it a little bit differently, but then also came to the same level of success, if not higher or more. And the business owner, the person who's either sold or is looking to sell or doesn't need to sell or whatever, and they have a operating business and they're multimillionaires, that core group of people has a willingness to do really, really, really hard, dirty things. So what I've noticed is that there is a lot of opportunity and margin in hard things. So whether it be working in cold climates, doing not very glamorous things, whether it be like oil and gas servicing. So that's, you're buying steam trucks, or you have water supply systems, or you're building unique valves that you're selling, or it's a certain metal alloy that you're building these things with, or your willingness to group a bunch of service people together and then insert them into larger oil and gas entities and selling that service. Those people have a willingness to do really, really hard things for long periods of time. So again, it's having a long term horizon and doing it for that period of time and realizing that none of this happens in 6 months or 1 year. We always overestimate what we can accomplish in 1 year and underestimate what we can do in 10. It's like this core human inability to understand exponential compounding of effort. So I find that is very similar to the doctor, because the doctor went into university being like, well, usually one, they're gifted. Like they're clearly high IQ and they usually come from like a pretty similar background in terms of their family also being high IQ and putting a huge amount of value on education. That then goes into their university career. They continue through and they're like, oh yeah, I'm going to be a doctor for sure. I'm doing this. Then their commitment to like building their resume.
Yeah.
This is a crazy, crazy long time horizon that you're taking at that young age. The willingness to do this at 16 and then hold it all the way through to 33 or 32 when you finally are done residency is not to be underestimated.
Yeah.
Think about what a 20-year-old thinks that they want to do. I've been listening to all these podcasts, and I shouldn't say podcasts, quick reels and TikToks of people being like, the white collar educated person is no longer going to make as much money as the plumber. And if you compound the earnings of the plumber for 10 years, they'll out earn the doctor. And like, yeah, I guess so. Mm. And sort of that's true in if you do the math, but in life, math and life are, they don't quite line up with each other.
Yeah.
And sure, there's multimillionaire plumbers too. Don't get me wrong. Like the sweaty startup matters. Like I think that that's a really important thing to do.
Yeah.
However, I think the, this group of people is incredibly unique, and I know this because I live with one, and I walked through this path with her, and her dedication and the challenge of going into med school, which is already one insanely difficult to do in Canada. And then two, getting into your residency program that you wanted in the city that you actually liked, that commitment to building your resume, to selling yourself and being attractive to that program, and then going through that residency program, completing it, and then dealing with the debt load that you have after that, and then applying it and going to work. That is a long-term approach that you have to take. Yeah. Young 20-year-old doesn't want to not make real money until they're 33 years old. That seems really far away. You're like, what do you mean? I went through my whole entire 20s when my body's in perfect shape, and I'm what, not going to get anything from it?
Mm.
It's hard to do, right? So you combine that cohort of people that I work predominantly with and another group, the business owner that has taken that exact same approach. They went their whole 20s, whole 30s building this massive asset, which is usually not realized until they sell or they're able to freeze it and then find partners to help take some equity off the table. It's exactly the same. It's literally just being like, I'm going to go through a ton of pain for 10 years. And then only then I'm going to finally start to realize it. And it's usually because they're really well prepared and they understand this. I think the doctor's a little bit more, understands it a little bit better.
Yeah.
But the successful entrepreneur, they might've been a little bit more ignorant going into their business creation, being like, I don't know, I'm going to make money way faster. But the reality is that they don't. But they have the fortitude and the, I think there's this benefit, this ignorance that they benefit from, not realizing just how insane they are going into it.
Right.
And then they grind.
Yep.
They just do the hard stuff.
Yep.
And the people that fail don't want to do the hard stuff.
Yeah.
Like if you just keep getting back up and doing it every single day and not giving up, there's almost no chance that you won't be successful.
Right.
I would say there's, I don't know a single person. And again, this is probably just like a bias.
Yeah.
And like, it definitely is a bias, but if you just keep trying, it will happen.
Mm-hmm.
Especially if you're doing stuff that other people don't want to.
Man, that advice is like, wow. I love that because I think that that's not talked about enough, especially today. I don't hear that enough of like, just put your head down, grind, look at the long-term game. And it's difficult. And I understand, I empathize with a young individual. I have a cousin that's really, really young. He's 19. And he, like you said, the timeline of like, he thinks in 3 years he's going to be a millionaire. And he has this, again, this, maybe it's ignorance is bliss. And I don't want to go to school because I see all these people online making insane amounts of money. But little does he know is that whether he takes the non-school route or whether he takes a school route, it's still going to be a fucking grind. It's still going to be extremely difficult to get, not even talking about, I want to be a millionaire. Cause that's like, as a young kid, you as a young male who is ambitious, you're like, I got to make a million in 3 years. Right. Not only that sort of ignorance or that, that sort of lens, but like the journey to even make 88,000, 100,000 is extremely difficult. So.
Well, to be fair, the first 100 is the hardest.
Right.
It's way easier after that.
So why is the first 100 the hardest?
Everyone should read 0 to 1, Peter Thiel.
Okay.
So it's 1 to 100, no problem. 0 to 1, my goodness, is it challenging? Because that's actually the base. It's like building a house, man.
Yeah.
The hardest part is the cribbing and the concrete and prepping the base of your house.
Right.
When you go and you do tile work in a house, like I'm currently going through all this stuff. And you're not realizing, right? No. Yeah, well, the prep.
Yeah, yeah.
The prep work is absurd. Mm. The framing, the floor work, getting everything built from the core base to then build your super tower from.
Yeah.
Everyone probably thinks doing the glass part and like all that is the hard part of building a tower. It's not even close.
It's the base.
It's the base. And no one wants to build a base. Everybody wants to do the fancy, cute stuff.
Yeah, yeah. Aesthetic.
Right? Yeah, it is, for sure. And that's another problem of this, like this YouTube, TikTok, real culture of, oh man, if I just have the proper desk setup, I'm going to be so productive. If I just have all this, I'm like, no, man, no, you won't.
If I just say positive affirmations in the mirror every
that'll work.
Morning.
Well, I mean, it might help you get up in the morning. Great. So do it.
Yeah.
And don't get me wrong, having a good mindset and being healthy and having, that comes back to having the right partner and having the right core base. And young people don't know that yet. How could you?
Yeah.
You're 22 or 20 or 19.
When you say 100,000, because I haven't read the book, but when you say 100,000, are you saying 100,000 in net worth? Or are you saying 100,000 in cash in the bank?
I don't know. Both doesn't matter.
Either or.
Honestly, if your ability to make 100 grand is important.
Right.
So you can take more risk when you have cash flow or even the access.
Yep.
Because that's another thing. I just feel I'm very lucky. I was born here. I have a good network because of family and the friends and the people that I grew up around.
Yeah.
All of that benefits me. You can't look at me and not think I'm like a moderately privileged person. I know that. But if you're not, find a way to become that.
Right.
That is like, don't feel bad about it and complain about it. Figure out how to get it.
Yeah.
Because it isn't the color part.
Yeah.
I'm being honest. It's truly, everyone needs to have, the privilege is truthfully the network. And sure, the access to that is determined by a lot of that a lot of the time.
Yep.
And I'm not going to deny that part.
Yep.
But when you go into there, it's everybody's there. All of them.
Right.
Like you go to those clubs and it's incredibly well diversified group of people.
Right.
If 100% is. Who do you think builds all the houses in this city?
Right. Brown people.
It sure as heck isn't me. It's not.
For sure.
They control a ton of capital in this city. For and they are very influential.
Yep.
And I hope that more people view it as being like, I just got to get in there. Make yourself useful to those people.
Yep.
Get in the same room. Learn from them. Mm-hmm. Be an asset. And then compound and get to your numbers that you need, right?
For sure.
I don't like the 100,000, the 88,000. That is a fact that that's what you need to own those things.
Yeah.
But again, it's just it's not an important number to shoot for.
No, I feel that. Joel, man, you've been dropping bars. Let's just put it that way. You've been dropping bars for the audience, man. So I appreciate it. I think personally, I got a ton of other questions, but we'll probably have to do a part two. So we'll wrap this up in 5-10 minutes, but I wanted to ask you one other thing is you mentioned a couple of times in this episode of, networking. Mm-hmm. And personally for me, as my journey as, you know, being a business owner and building my business to where it is today, I've realized that more and more over the last couple of years, how important that network is, having, you know, key individuals that essentially will like change your life or change the trajectory of your business or mm-hmm. whatever the case may be. Initially, when I started as a sort of as a younger individual, you think that networking is going to networking events and pulling out your business card and like selling yourself. I think that sure, the networking events can give you a little bit. I feel like that's a little bit surface level
mm-hmm.
personally, the networking event. I think networking in the sense of actually building a relationship with the individual across from you. And so I know, especially, and I always go back to my younger cousin because he always asks me questions and he's always asking for advice. And it's easy to brush up the resume and like put whatever you want on your resume to make it look like super clean and polished, wear a jacket and go to a networking event and try to throw business cards to 100 people. I think that doesn't necessarily work. It might work. You might fall, like you might find an individual in that crowd who you might do business with. But I feel like actual networking is, like you said, how do you get into these circles? How do you get into these rooms with individuals who could potentially change your life? But how do you do that? And the how is actually getting into more depth with that individual across from you. Mm-hmm. And again, it's like, okay, well, how do you do that? How do you build that relationship? And one thing that's worked a lot for me is you know, either taking an individual out for coffee if I can, or, you know, even bringing them onto the pod, having that sort of one-on-one time to be able to build that relationship. Now, not all the time does that work. I'm not saying you just go and try to, because you can easily try to reach out to people and say, hey, I'm a young guy, I'm ambitious, can we go for coffee? I want to pick your brain. Some people, some mentors or individuals who are really successful in their space, they might be open and willing to, but again, they might be extremely busy. So why would they take on a half an hour coffee with a 19-year-old or a 20-year-old? But I think the how and figuring that out is the most important thing. Not necessarily like, I'm just going to polish up my resume and try to apply or try to go talk to this individual. It's like, that individual is so much more busier than you, has a million different problems. But if you can try to build a personal relationship with that individual relatively, and not sort of a surface level, like you're selling, like, I have real estate services, like, please hire me when you do your next build.
Yep.
You know, that I think is the idea of networking and really building that network. What do you think of that?
I think you're saying all the right things.
Right.
But, and this is not, this would be more of an addition, I think.
Yeah.
Everyone should be going to networking events. Everyone should be polished and going to those things. Have a polished resume. All that's right. I think that the one differentiator is when you're in your 20s, be a yes person. Everyone's like, oh no, you got to say no to things. Mm. Like, no, you can't. Like, you need to be willing to go out and do things out of your comfort zone. And that's not just introducing yourself, which again, in and of itself is hard. Going into these rooms is hard, but that's just table stakes.
Right.
You got to do way more than that.
Right.
So what I'm saying is like, you need to be willing, even if your career and your ambition in a certain area isn't even being addressed in this conversation with someone and they need something done, do it. Mm. I don't care what it is. Like, I was doing financial modeling for companies, for young people starting them up. And that's not what I do for a living. I was doing it for them because that was a value add that I would do. I'm like, I would do anything to make your business more successful for free, literally for free. And I did it for 7 years straight. I still do it for people, being like, no, I'll do what I think you want me to do to make you more successful so that you want to work with me. Mm-hmm. And that I can then help you get to this place for 30 years.
Right.
And so if you're going into these networking rooms with people or into areas and they have problems, I literally don't care what that problem is. It could be landscaping their backyard for their kid.
Yeah.
I'm telling you, if you do this stuff, it is the differentiator. It's not because you have the specific skill in one area that they want. And like, yeah, maybe that happens, but there's like, it's a needle in a haystack.
Yeah.
Find that person, be that person for them.
Yeah.
The willingness to do hard things, difficult things for them, mm-hmm, that they don't want to do. Because again, you're in your 20s. Even my brothers are in their 20s. And one's 24. My other brother is 31 or whatever, 30. But if they look at me and they're like, well, how are you so busy? Why can't you go do all this stuff? Why aren't you working out more? I'm like, dude.
Yeah, yeah.
I have so much stuff going on.
Yeah.
If you just come and you do the things I don't want to do, or things that I can't or don't have time to do, so I can have a do the more the stuff that's more important to or more profitable for me, then you're helping me get to where I need to go. If a 20-year-old looks at a 30-year-old and like, oh, you should have lots of time to do this. They don't, I'm telling you. The 40-year-old's even worse.
Right.
That successful person is so obscenely busy. I don't even think people quite grasp how busy they are. Right. They have so much, until they get to ultra success level where they've now made it so big that they can then push everything off.
Right.
But that still doesn't matter. That person wants to see you help their person do right. The things and make their life easier. So what I'm effectively saying is, if you're getting into this commercial real estate room where there's all these guys and they're developers or they're, let's say they're, yeah, you're building houses or whatever, find what they need, do it for free, and then be like, this is how good I can do it for you.
Mm.
and then they will respect that. And maybe they don't want your service anymore.
Right.
They send it to their friend because their friends are probably the same level of success as them.
Probably.
And maybe that's the person that ends up being your, the guy who changes your life, or the woman who changes your life, or the family that changes your life. Maybe that business changes your view on the world. All I will promise anyone who's in their 20s looking to network is that you have no idea which room is going to be the one that changes your life. And you never will. I still don't know which the next one will be.
Right.
It might be someone completely different. But when someone invites you to something, go. If they are interested in seeing what you got to do, do it. If they are they mention a hard thing, even if it doesn't sound like something you can do, do it.
Right.
That is how you truly differentiate yourself. But then also you get the compounding effects of that networking. Because the biggest thing that I see is people saying it doesn't work. And you know why it doesn't work? Is because you think that you can only do your little subset of expertise that you have in your 20s, which is almost nothing.
Yeah.
Once you get into your 30s and you're a yes person, you can start saying no a little bit more.
Right.
But even now, I'm doing this weird stuff for everybody.
Yeah.
And I have people at RBCDS that are like my competitors or my colleagues. They're like, Joel, why do you do all this stuff for people? Well, one, I'm addicted to doing it now. Mm-hmm. Or it's now just part of my process. And it is something that I need to get better at saying no to.
Right.
But at the same time, I'm still building. I'm still not even close to the biggest in our city.
Right.
And I want to be.
Right.
So how do I do that? I go and I do the hard stuff, and I'm going to do it for another 20 years, and then we'll see when I'm 60 what's going on.
Right.
Or 50, whatever, right? So
no.
I think for young people, just say yes to everything, whether it be like, oh, no, I need someone to babysit my kid. Yeah, we'll go do it.
Yeah, for sure.
Like, what, you're not doing anything.
For sure.
Like, they're just going for dinner. You go babysit.
Yeah. No, totally. I think that's incredible advice, and I think that is the thing that even me, when I think about it, that's what I was missing, because I thought I wasn't thinking in that way earlier on. And I think that, again, I look at my cousin and I look at, you know, some of the younger individuals that are in my circle, and they ask these sort of pending questions of like, well, how do I talk to this person? Or how do I build my network and this and that? And that right there, everything that you just said, I think, is what is going to change your trajectory as a young individual. So I appreciate that advice, Joel. Last thing I'm going to end off with, because I would love to do a part two with you on this stuff, but just to end it off, things that you see, any investment advice for mid, early 30s, young individuals, something that they can look for. Is there something you see in the market today, whether that's a specific stock or if that's a specific industry, real estate, all that sort of jazz? We can keep it broad because we don't have time to get into the depths for this episode. But one piece of investment advice that you can give that's broad enough that you think is relevant or something that individuals can look at today.
Yeah, the lamest thing I'm going to say is like invest in yourself. Ooh.
Yeah.
Which is true, and it's the truest thing ever. But if you're truly, you got some money on the side and you want to do something, my best advice to people is to look at what the Canadian government and Alberta government's doing and the municipal governments are doing. How's the budget changing? It's the reason why I always do a budget review in my podcast. Mm-hmm. What's the budget highlighting? Because that is where you're going to get a ton of tailwinds. So what's going to happen in the federal budget? What's going to happen in the Alberta budget? The Alberta budget just came out. So if you're looking at the Alberta budget, what are they multiplying? Well, forest, flood, and fire is getting a doubling of their budget. Find a business in there. Real estate is in high demand. We are still only producing 18% of the required new house and home starts. Service company, business, real estate, whatever. That is, in my opinion, an incredibly large opportunity. For a good 15 years, my entire 20s, real estate was a horrible investment. We saw no price appreciation in single family homes, effectively. I mean, we had a little bit, but not much. Now, it's on fire. So that's a tailwind. I'm a big believer in momentum investing, whether it be public markets or private markets. And when government capital moves somewhere, especially in Canada, it's more important than it is in the United States. When government capital goes somewhere, you should be paying attention.
Love that, man. Love that. Mm-hmm. Last thing I'm going to ask is, first off, I appreciate you coming on the pod. So thank you, man. Thank you for making the time to come on. I know our audience is going to get a ton of value from this podcast. Where can people find you? Where can they, the content that you produce? I know where they can find you, but yeah. Where can they find you? Just plug in your socials or website or anything like that.
Joel Shackleton on Twitter. Find me on LinkedIn. I post most there now. And then my podcast, Reform Millennials, check it out. I'm not posting as frequently as I want to, but come May, June, I'm going to be, doing the weekly again. If you want my posts and what I'm saying, what I'm thinking, definitely check out my newsletter, which again is Reform Millennials, and then to LinkedIn. That's where I'm posting most little things, market tips. And if you want to reach out to me, you can find me online and you're welcome to email whenever you want. Somebody will respond.
Cool, man. Well, like I said, thanks, man, for coming on The Second Floor. If you guys enjoyed this episode, make sure to drop, comment, like. You're going to see a lot of posts on socials on this episode, but we'll see y'all next week.